bots that copy our behavior to steal money from the ad companies. The first look at the iPhone XR, why 5G is not the answer for everyone, and scooters are moving fast and breaking people. All that and more coming up on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 55, recorded Thursday, October 25th, 2018.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Brex, the first corporate credit card for startups. Get the card free, and TWiT listeners get Brex card fees waived in perpetuity at brex.com/twit.
And by Command Line Heroes, a podcast from Red Hat. Listen to the epic true tales of the developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels revolutionizing the technology landscape. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit redhat.com/heroes today.
Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is a show where we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I'm Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. Yes, big Android news this week, which Android's, you know, close to my heart, so I'm always watching it closely. But this is a very interesting story. Android is pretty used to getting a bad rap when it comes to platform security. There are stories all the time about how this thing was hacked or that app was, let's say, devious or mischievous in some way. That might be putting it lightly. Let's just say it's hard to surprise when it comes to new Android security threats. But a new BuzzFeed investigation reveals a devious ad fraud scheme that is impressive in its depth and its approach. Joining us to discuss the report is Craig Silverman, who wrote about it for BuzzFeed. Welcome, Craig.
Hello. Thank you.
It's great to have you here. So first of all, what exactly clued you guys into this elaborate scheme? There's a whole lot of machinations going on here. It's pretty complicated how it's all set up. What kind of drew you into this to begin with?
It is a pretty big and sophisticated scheme. The first tip-off that I got to it was back in June. A company that helps detect ad fraud by the name of Pixelate had actually discovered an initial, what turned out to be a small part of this larger fraud scheme, where they found one app called Megacast had basically been pretending to be other apps in order to get advertising that people thought they would be placing on those. And then after they sort of published their investigation, I dug in a little bit more to see, well, you know, what's the next level here? And it turned out that a lot of these apps that they thought had actually been victims were in fact connected through corporate ownership, IP addresses, a whole range of different things that we started to find as we investigated. And it just got bigger and bigger and bigger to the point where ultimately I was able to find about more than 125 Android apps, as well as some video websites that were all connected in this one large scheme.
So talking about the large scheme, you actually detail it pretty well in your article, the order of events as far as kind of the strategy, as it were, around this ad fraud, from acquiring these companies to kind of, you know, training bots and everything. Talk a little bit about that process and why it's so different.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of deviously clever, right? The way they went about it. So the first step is that, of course, there's lots of independent developers or small companies building Android apps. And so what these folks did was they had kind of a third party called We Purchase Apps. And the We Purchase Apps would approach these developers and say, hey, I'd like to purchase your app.
Weird.
And in a lot of cases, you know, these weren't super popular apps. They weren't doing a lot of monetization, if at all. And so they would offer these developers what was a really good price for those apps. And the developers would be like, oh, this is great, you know. And so the app would get sold. And then pretty soon the app would be put into the Play Store under a different developer's name. And these were shell companies that were registered in places like Bulgaria or Cyprus or Malta. And from there, what the fraudsters would do is they would study the existing human audience that was already in there. So the real people who downloaded the app, the real people who were using it, and they looked at their behavior, where they clicked, how long they spent on the app, where in the world they were coming from, all that kind of stuff. And then they would train bots to mimic this. So in effect, they were tracking user behavior to then train bots to mimic those humans. And of course, if you throw the bots in along with the humans, then it's disguised. You don't know what's real and what's fake. So that evades some of the fraud detection. And of course, then you can start earning a whole lot more money than before because you're able to basically fabricate as much audience as you want.
Wow.
Okay, so the developers who sold their apps, they got money for their apps. They were actually paid. And then the people, most of these apps were free to download, or if the customer paid for the app, the app worked as promised. So they got what they were getting. And the advertisers paid Google. So Google got what it, was promised. So the real victim here is the advertisers.
Yeah, so that's the thing with digital ad fraud, and I've spent about a year now publishing investigations into it. First of all, it's massive. There's roughly about $19 billion or more that will be stolen this year. Like, not ads that sort of didn't work or were misplaced, 100% stolen. And so in this case, and in ad fraud in general, you have all these players in the supply chain, everybody who's getting paid as they take their little piece, as you know, the money flows from a brand all the way into an app or a website. And you're right. At the end of the day, whose money is it? It's the money of the people who are trying to place advertising. So big brands, small, medium-sized companies who spent money, but you know, along the way, instead of showing it to a real audience, it actually ended up being shown to bots or in some other way fraudulent. And that money, you know, unless it's exposed, that money is gone forever. In this case, Google says that on their ad networks alone, about $10 million was stolen. So now they're figuring out how to kind of refund that money.
Now, $10 million on their ads alone, but that, you also point out in the article that that's like, potentially, that's like a tenth of what was actually stolen here, right? This could amount to way more money when all things are investigated.
Yeah. So at one point, there was kind of an inside source who had told Pixelate, who had estimated that, you know, this one attack they found in June, they thought, oh, that could steal about $75 million a year. And then this source, who was from a company deeply involved in the scheme, actually emailed them and said, hey, it's probably about 10 times that. So the estimate from an insider is that it's hundreds of millions of dollars. But I'll tell you, here's the thing that I've experienced, which is that nobody wants to admit how much money has been stolen. So I give Google some credit. They actually stood up and they published a blog post and they said how much money they think it was. But none of the other ad networks that were helping monetize this traffic have stood up and said that. In fact, most of the responses I'm getting are them saying it was very small. So according to them, nobody lost any money, which doesn't make any sense at all.
So let's talk a little bit about the apps that are kind of involved here and whether the developers themselves, the original developers, like whether there may have ever been any sort of clues to them whatsoever. You said they were kind of small-time developers, although one of the apps, I think, had a pretty big kind of following and then went away. And then what do you know? It came back in a magical sort of way because it had been acquired here. Like, are these apps that people, that the majority of people have never heard of, or are they more popular than that?
So there is a mix. I mean, overall, when I totaled it up, these apps have been installed more than 115 million times. So cumulatively, we're talking about a lot of installs. Yeah. The biggest app, the one that you mentioned, was one called Everything Me, which is actually still in the Play Store. And so that one was a very popular app, had actually won a Webby, was featured by Google. But then the really hot startup behind it went out of business. And what happened was in about 2016, somebody came along and kind of quietly bought it up and put it back in the Play Store. And so for the most part, you're looking at apps that have about 500,000, 1 million, 2, 3, 4 million installs. And then there were a couple of outliers where you had more than 5 million, more than 10 million installs. And you know, for the purposes of doing something like this, you don't want to attract too much attention to yourself. So having lots of shell companies to spread the apps around sort of distributes your risk. And also making sure that you aren't running apps that are super duper popular, where people are really exercising a lot of scrutiny over who you are, and Google really wants to pay attention to you. So getting that middle of the road popularity, I think, really helped them in the end.
There seems to be, and this is such a smart scam, there seems to be a lot of knowledge of how the app store works, how the review process works. This Everything Me, like I felt like I remembered this app, so I looked it up. And the first link when you look it up on Google is, you know, how sad it is that this app went out of business because people loved it so much. So it seems like they really might have gone after, okay, here's a pretty popular app that never figured out how to make money to survive. And so we can figure out how to make money to survive by being very clever and also breaking the law. But knowing that that Google doesn't go back and check to see if you've continued to follow their rules. Like, do you think these people are in the ad business to know so much?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in the story, I've actually identified four people who are key beneficiaries of this. Two of them used to run a hosting company, so they have the experience, you know, running, setting up, administrating servers, which you need in order to, you know, to set up the bots and run the bots. And, you know, another one was somebody who had been distributing software that was classified as PUP. So on the edge of it being malware, stuff that would get on people's computers and they wouldn't know how to uninstall. And then, you know, the fourth one was somebody who actually is a huge shareholder in a mobile apps development company based in Serbia. So when you put all the four of them together, they have the experience in advertising. They have the experience, you know, with servers and databases, and they actually have a mobile apps development studio up and running. So all the pieces were there.
And is this the kind of thing, like I said, you know, kind of in the intro of this story, we're so used to hearing about this and that bad thing as related to Android. Is this the kind of thing that could only happen on the Android OS, or, you know, could this very, very easily happen on iOS as well or other mobile platforms?
You know, a lot of the experts that I spoke to about this, and I think you talked about it a little bit off the top, you know, they do say that the Android ecosystem is, you know, one of the benefits, I guess, of it is that it's open. It's kind of easier to work with if you're a developer, I suppose. But of course, that increases the amount of risks and threats for the potential end user. And so I do think that it's not an accident that they were only working in Android. Obviously, for them, it makes sense to focus on one mobile ecosystem and just develop for Android rather than mixing and having to find different skill sets for that. But overall, the experts I spoke to, they do feel that Apple does a better job with security review initially as apps get into its app store and then on an ongoing basis. And, you know, the reality is these apps, they changed owners, you know, different code was put into them. There's a lot about these apps that changed over time, but they never really flagged, you know, the right things at Google for Google to re-review them and take a look at what they were doing. And so they got away with it.
Mm-hmm.
So today you posted another piece that Senator Mark Warner, based on your research into this, is trying to encourage the FTC to go after digital ad fraud. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the senator is somebody who actually, I'll give him credit, he was sending letters to the FTC back in 2016 about ad fraud. So he's somewhat of an old hand at this, and he raised the issue then that, you know, this is stealing a lot of money. As I mentioned earlier, this year, about $19 billion. And it goes up every single year. So the industry is not stopping it from happening, and nobody is getting fired, and nobody is going to jail over this. And so he's telling the FTC, we need to look at this. And one of the things that's interesting is he relates it kind of to the Russian interference in the 2016 election. He says, you know, some people are exploiting ad tech, bots, trolls, social networks to sow political division and spread disinformation, but other people are exploiting it to steal money. And so he's calling on the FTC to spend more time and more attention on this. And he's also pretty hard on Google, saying that, you know, perhaps they're not knowingly engaging in this. He said, you know, there is no evidence of that, but he accuses them of having a willful blindness to allow this to take place, because in some cases, you know, they are actually earning money from it.
Yeah, that's really indicative of the lens through which more and more people are looking at stories like this, right? Like 2 years ago, maybe the ire would not be directed as severely on a large company like Google. But right now, man, you know, it's we're firmly in kind of this sea change that's happening, where people are looking at these large tech companies differently and realizing, hey, it's actually quite convenient for you to not, you know, to create these tools and not really do as much as maybe you should be doing to clamp down on this, because in the end, it makes you a lot of money.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a fair point. It's a fair point to question, you know, what the incentives are for these companies to really dig into this. And I think it's fair to point out that right now, Senator Warner and others in the government aren't too happy with Google, because while other companies like Facebook and Twitter have sent their CEOs to go and testify on Capitol Hill, Google has resisted that, and the Senate and the House committees are not happy about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Craig Silverman, of course, BuzzFeed.com, and definitely follow him, follow you, your work there. You do some excellent work there. If people want to follow you, like on the social media or just anywhere on the internet, where do you point people?
So I am at Craig Silverman on Twitter. Would love for you to follow me. I mean, I look at ad fraud, but also lots of elements of digital media manipulation, as well as misinformation and disinformation.
Awesome. Craig Silverman, really appreciate you taking the time. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
The iPhone XR goes on sale this week on October 26th, but some reviewers have had their hands on the newest iPhone for long enough to tell us what they think. One of those people is Mark Spoonhour from Tom's Guide. Welcome back to the show, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
So the biggest difference between the iPhone XS and the slightly cheaper iPhone XR is the display. Now, what are your thoughts on the LCD screen of the new phone?
I think it depends on where you're coming from, right? So if you've had an iPhone 8 or iPhone 7 before and you like LCDs, I think you're going to like this one too. It's very colorful. It is very bright. But, you know, the snobs among us, and I admit that in the review, we know that OLED displays give you more saturated colors, the perfect black levels, and wider viewing angles, right? So if you're sharing content with someone else, you're definitely going to know that when you're a little off axis. But I think for the vast majority of people, this LCD, especially at 6.1 inches, which is a pretty nice size, is really good.
So we know it doesn't compare to OLED, but how does it compare to other LCDs? You said in your piece that they achieved some upgrades to this LCD.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So it's definitely among the best in its class, not just because of like the colors and the brightness, which is what we expected. It's also very color accurate. And they've done some really cool things in terms of being able to deliver an iPhone XS-like design, like the work with curving the display all the way to the edges and giving you the impression that it is like an OLED phone. Like being able to curve an LCD is actually no small feat. And they've done a lot of like things behind the scenes to make that happen.
Why? I'm curious to know why that is. I guess I don't understand much about like the actual constructive differences, you know, that the capabilities of LCD versus OLED. We're so used to seeing it in OLED. And I guess before your piece, I realized that's probably because that's an OLED thing that I've seen them everywhere. Those phones probably have OLED. Why is it such a challenge for LCD to do that?
Just because OLEDs are just more malleable, and I think, and that's part of the reason why when foldable phones come on the market, they're going to be using OLED displays. Mm-hmm. So in the case of an LCD, it's a lot more engineering expertise that's needed to go into it. And they also did some tricks in terms of anti-aliasing and what they call sort of pixel masking, so that the bezel around the iPhone XR, it looks a little bit bigger. I'm going to turn down the brightness a little bit. It looks a little bit bigger than it is on the iPhone XS, and that's partly because as you get closer to the edge of the display, part of the bezel is actually part of the screen, which I know is kind of weird, but they really wanted to deliver an iPhone XS-like look and feel so that across the line, there was this uniformity of design.
So they could, so technically they could have less bezel, but they're keeping those pixels blackened out to give it more of a uniform bezel sort of approach?
That's right. And we're only talking about millimeters here.
Right.
But, you know, when you walk into an Apple store, I mean, it's very important to them that the look and feel is very similar across the line. And they've achieved that.
That's interesting.
So the other way they brought down the price was by having no 3D touch in this phone, but they have haptic touch. Explain what the difference between haptic touch and 3D touch is.
Right. So the biggest difference is that when you're on the home screen, like a lot of people, you do things like force press into shortcuts for apps directly from the home screen. But I think over time, most people have not really used that, and a lot of developers haven't really taken advantage of that feature. So what's good about haptic touch is that it's very similar. So let's say you're on the home screen and you want to activate the camera or the flashlight. Instead of like a force press, you just sort of press and hold, and then you'll feel the haptic feedback. It's very similar to what you'll get on a touchpad for the MacBook Pro, right? So, and the other important thing for me is that at least I do a lot of editing on the go, especially on the iPhone itself. When you press and hold on the space bar on the keyboard, you could then move the cursor around, which is actually one of those features that I wish that Android phones have. It, like for them, you just have to point your finger where you want the cursor to go, which is a little bit less precise.
Yeah, I've actually noticed there are some keyboards, and the Google keyboard, I feel like used to do this, but then it didn't do it the last time, where you can do that, where you can hold down on the space bar and drag left and right, but it doesn't allow you to use the full keyboard as kind of like a touchpad for moving the cursor up and down. It's literally just left to move it further left, and you know maybe it eventually goes up to the next line, but it looks a lot more intuitive on what you were showing off.
Yeah, so I think the bottom line is that for that particular feature, you're not really giving much up.
Yeah. Yeah. What, now, you mentioned camera, so we might as well talk about that. Yeah. One of the things that that you point out is, of course, the loss of optical zoom. Optical zoom, like, you know, actual optical zoom versus like a digital zoom solution, right, maybe save for the new Pixel 3 because it does digital zoom really well, I have to admit.
Right.
But optical zoom, I figure, is just one of those things that if you can have it, you should have it. It's just such a useful feature. But this does not have optical zoom on it, right?
Right. And that's one of the trade-offs that Apple made. And maybe it was a cost concession in terms of having that second lens. And that example that you're seeing there, especially when you zoom in, you'll see that the text is a little bit sharper on the iPhone XS Max compared to the iPhone XR. But it's also just sort of like when you're using the camera in day-to-day situations. So this morning, for example, I walked out of the house and it was way too early. The moon was still out. And it was like breaking, like, between the trees, and I just wanted to press that button and boom, zoom in, right? As opposed to, you know, pinching and zooming and trying to get it just right. It's just like a really nice feature to have that I think some people would miss if they are stepping up from, let's say, an iPhone 7 Plus, right, or an iPhone 8 Plus. But the good news is that you are getting portrait mode, right? And that works fairly well.
So that was my next question. What's the difference between the portrait mode on the 10R and the 10S? Mm-hmm.
Sure. So the biggest difference was that there's two. One is that for now, it only works for people. So unlike the Pixel 3 or Pixel 2, where you could use it for pretty much anything, like, you know, flowers or whatever you're taking a picture of, the depth effect only works for people. And so it'll actually say, we're, you know, waiting for a person to enter the frame, which is kind of interesting. So over time, who knows, they'll make it a little bit smarter. The other thing is, like, that example that you're seeing there between the iPhone 10R and I think it's the Pixel 3, is that is actually a zoomed in crop that we did because the iPhone 10R does not have a telephoto zoom. So when you are taking portraits, you're a little bit more zoomed out than you are on the other iPhone. So it doesn't mean it's a worse portrait. It just looks a little bit different.
Hmm. So who do you think should buy the 10 and who should buy the 10R? I mean, the 10S, so, 10S and 10R.
Yeah. So I actually think it comes a lot down to size. So when you think about the lineup that they have, the iPhone XS gives you a 5.8-inch display. And it is a little bit of a bummer that if you want something that's truly one-hand friendly, you have to step up to a $1,000 phone if you want a new phone in Apple's lineup, right? On the other hand, I think the reason why Apple went with 6.1 inches for the iPhone XR is that the appetite for big phones is just increasing. And I think a lot of people want to so-called, you know, future-proof their purchase because we're using our phones for a lot more, especially like binge-watching videos, Instagram, and that sort of thing. So a lot of people want to have the bigger display. So I feel like that's really the biggest differentiator. And then other than that, you know, for the iPhone XS Max, I think right there it's really more about, do you want to have that 2X optical zoom, and are you willing to pay more for a closer-to-perfect OLED display?
Now, you also talk a lot about battery, and you seem very positive on the battery life. Big boost with this device. I'm always kind of curious because everybody has kind of a different, you know, judge or basis to judge that on, right? Like, you know, I've got X amount of apps syncing, whatever. Like on your daily usage, what did that kind of translate out to? Is it that you would normally, you know, plug your phone at night and you would see like 10% remaining, but on this one you saw 20%? Or was it that noticeable of a difference?
I would say it's closer to 20% in terms of, you know, the day-to-day usage. And what we do and what you see right there, it's a web surfing battery test, right? So obviously not everyone's going to be surfing the web for 11 hours in a row.
Sure.
But we try to mirror real-world usage in the sense that we're picking up our phones, 150 to 200 times a day, right? So what we do with our battery test is that we do keep the screen on, but we wait 30 seconds to go to the next website. And we use the 30 of the most popular websites. And we also dialed down the brightness to 150 nits, which is about, on the iPhone, for example, it's about 50%. So it is pretty close to real-world usage. And I think the fact that you are getting close to an hour more over the iPhone XS Max and even more over the iPhone XS, I think that's one really big reason to go for the 10R, especially if you care about endurance.
Is there any possibility that the different screen technologies, the LCD versus OLED, is improving that factor at all?
In this case, I don't think so. I think what you're going to find in the teardowns, which are not out yet, I think they will be soon, is that the iPhone XR will likely have a bigger battery in terms of the milliamp hours. OLED like there's pros and cons to both. Like, and it also depends on what you have on the screen. So if you're watching content with a dark background, for example, on OLEDs, you are going to get longer battery life because it's not firing up those pixels, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
So I know your review of the Pixel 3 also came out this week. So leaving aside the camera, I mean, I think everyone agrees the Pixel 3 camera is better. Of course, than the 10R, maybe even better than the 10S for some things. Would you? How else did the two compare, the 10R and the Pixel 3? I mean, I know it's sort of, you know, we probably would all say, well, you're either in the iOS ecosystem or you're in the Android ecosystem. But I know people, you know, switch back and forth. So how would you compare those two phones? Other than the camera,
I would say like the biggest other difference is Google Assistant and what you can do with it, and the overall smarts of the phone. I really do feel like Google is putting the smart back in smartphone, and they started last year with really highlighting Google Assistant. But now that, like, I'll give you an example. So Google Lens, the fact that that is built into the camera, you don't even have to go to a separate setting. And you could just point it at something like a plant or flowers or a business, and just learn more about it like right on the spot. Apple doesn't have anything like that. And I think the other big difference is what they're doing with, you guys are probably familiar with the screen call feature, where, you know, if you're getting a call from someone that you don't know, Google Assistant can step in on your behalf and say, hey, I'm Google Assistant. And they can start transcribing the call in real time so you could decide whether or not you want to pick up. So it's like those types of features, like iPhone owners will say they really wish that they had on their phone. But I don't know if Google's gotten to the point where people are like, you know what, I'm going to just give up iOS altogether, because they still have that pull, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've received a couple of calls where that call screening feature has appeared, and I don't know why. I know I need to test it out, but I was like afraid to get into it. I can't tell you exactly why. It was easier for me to just be like, it's an unknown caller. I'm just going to let them either choose to leave a message or you know, hang up, than it was for me to like, go through the button pressing options of the call screening. I need to get over that, apparently.
It kind of makes you feel like a digital bouncer.
Yeah, totally. Totally. It was almost, to a certain, like, it's magical and it's very interesting, but it was kind of more work than I wanted to do at that moment. Yeah. You know, it's like, well, why would I do that? If it's important, they'll leave me a message.
Well, my question about that also is, like, I don't want to answer spam calls because I'm afraid then they'll know it's a live phone number.
Yeah.
And then they'll keep calling me. Is that, I don't know if that's true or not. Do you know?
You know, I'm not sure, but I feel like, you know, once Google Assistant gets involved in a call like that, they're not going to, chances are they're not going to call back, right? Because they know that they're going to, you know, meet a robot instead of you.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's a good point.
Well, Mark, thank you so much. Mark Spoonhauer is editor-in-chief at Tom's Guide. You can read his review of the 10R. You can read his review of the Pixel 3 and all the other products he gets his hands on. And you can also find him at M. Spoonhauer on Twitter. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Mark.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, we'll talk to you soon.
After the break, who is 5G good for and who does it leave out? We will find out. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Brex, the first corporate credit card for startups. Brex is a card you can use at millions of merchants across 200 countries where Visa is accepted. The application process takes only about 5 minutes. The card is underwritten based on your cash. That's the cash in your bank account. They also promise limits that are 10 to 20 times higher than other corporate credit cards. Plus, no personal liability required. Now, there's so many great reasons to give your employees a corporate card if they need to charge business expenses. It's not fair to make them charge it to their own cards and then wait for you to pay them back. Here's what else Brex offers. High-value rewards specifically tailored to your modern business. That means high multipliers on services that business people spend the most. That's 7 times on ride-sharing, 3 times on restaurants and travel, and 2 times on software. Plus, exclusive offers with some of the best technology brands and services like AWS, Google, Salesforce, and WeWork. Brex underwrites your company, not you. No minimum operating history, no painful paper application or personal liability required. Brex uses the cash raised by your business to extend credit and doesn't require a credit score, doesn't require a social security number or a security deposit. Plus, you get embedded expense management software with your Brex card, and it's powered by the Visa network. Here's how it works. You instantly issue cards to employees, set limits, and control spend via virtual cards. Brex offers employees instant access to online virtual credit cards with physical credit cards sent in the mail shortly thereafter. Every employee can have a corporate card with real-time limits that an administrator can adjust for you. If you and your employees are annoyed by having to save receipts, don't. Just reply to your text message with a picture of your receipt and it's automatically matched to the transaction. And Brex integrates with major accounting software programs. Join the thousands of startups and tech companies who use Brex to manage their growing business needs and earn valuable rewards while doing so. Get the card free, and as a special offer for TWIT listeners, you get Brex card fees waived in perpetuity. All the Brex card fees waived in perpetuity. Just go to brex.com/twit. Check it out. Go and see the offer for yourself. That's brex.com/twit. And we thank Brex very much for their support.
All right. 5G technology wars are heating up as we get closer and closer to actual 5G networks launching in the U.S. markets. AT&T says that it plans to launch its network in the coming weeks. Verizon, of course, has plans for early 2019. There's been a lot of news around that. There's a lot of positivity around how 5G technology could be the saving grace for broadband-starved rural markets. Ernesto Falcone from the Electronic Frontier Foundation says that a recent study shows how it won't improve broadband access in those markets after all. Welcome back to the show, Ernesto.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's always great to get you here. We appreciate you taking the time. So let's start with the potential of 5G networks in the U.S., maybe from the optimistic point of view. What is the potential there?
So, you know, faster speeds and higher capacity to move information wirelessly is, you know, is always a good thing, right? We should always want the internet to be faster and more robust. Probably the most useful innovation from the 5G world is this idea called network slicing, which is you can have different types of services, essentially sliced throughout the network, and they're all supported independently. For example, you know, if you need low latency, high security, and some sort of specialized tailoring for a service, you can do that with 5G, and then you can have your broadband pipe, and you can have something for high latency, or you don't really worry about things like the Internet of Things. You can have all these networks run simultaneously without necessarily depriving one another of, attention.
Got it. So, basically, the foundation of your article kind of resides on the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. They conducted a survey that details the failure of government subsidized programs to actually encourage rural broadband investment. How exactly is this failing to date? I mean, it lists a number of very specific examples, all the major players in broadband right now. How's that failing?
So the problem we have right now is we are not as a country really focused on how do we get to a point where everyone has, you know, high speed and affordable connections. What is happening now, particularly with rural America, is we are trying to, you know, looking at a way to get them the bare minimum of connection and then feeling that may be good enough. So we're talking about a lot of copper networks, a lot of telephone networks and stretching, you know, speeds that barely get you anything. The people are feeling good about 25 megabits down and 3 up. But, you know, doing something like this, what we're doing now, talking on a live video conference, you know, you're going to be stretched on those kind of connections, and we are missing the forest for the trees. The internet in terms of access speed has moved well beyond, you know, anything in the double or even triple digits. You know, what we have now in many markets in the international space is fiber to the home being spread in more markets where you could do 10, you know, 1 gigabit connections and 10 gigabit and even further. So, you know, the internet's going a lot faster. We're just not seeing it here in the United States, and there's not a national drive to give all people that type of speed.
And when we're talking about rural areas getting this kind of speed, we're not just talking about like people in rural areas being able to stream their Netflix. I mean, there's a lot of farming technologies that require good mobile connectivity and other things that are really, I mean, fast internet connections is becoming like really necessary, important, yeah. Very necessary.
So an interesting thing happened in a small town of Texas. I forget the name of it, but the town. But it was, you know, 30 miles out of any city, and what they did is the city decided to build their own fiber optic network, and they basically had speeds of like 5 megabits down from their cable provider and, you know, 7 megabits down from the DSL provider. I mean, really pathetic speeds, and they're able to leapfrog past all that with you know, symmetrical gigabit connection. And you're actually exactly right. I mean, it's video is important in the sense of, you know, consumption, but what we're talking about at the end of the day is interactivity. If you want to participate at a university and you're unable to travel there, you know, a high speed connection is how you can do it. If you want to work remotely anywhere in the world that allows you to work remotely, you know, high speed connection is essential. So it is getting to the point where the opportunities for information, the opportunities to interact with the rest of the world, the opportunities to you know, kind of excel are really growing more and more dependent on a very fat pipe, if you will.
Well, and talking about these subsidies, I think what's fascinating to me is that they're targeting basically mandatory speeds of 10 megabits per second down, 1 megabit per second up. But that doesn't even really qualify as, air quotes, broadband. Broadband is actually much faster than that. Yet these subsidies are meant to encourage that. Why is that so off base?
So it's, you know, what it's doing is when you're giving a really low ball target for the subsidy, and it's funny because the industry works really hard to keep it low. All you're basically getting the companies to do in exchange for federal subsidies is extend the copper line network or put down some sort of a tower that does like a microwave transmission to another tower, essentially kind of doing as cheap as possible for as little as possible. Mm-hmm. And what I think the policy needs to reframe itself to is like, how do we push fiber in more parts of the country? Because the further you get fiber into these markets, then you've solved, you know, the universal access problem, because fiber has such a huge potential to grow. You know, if you can get the infrastructure out there, then rural Americans can have access to the fastest speed, just like urban Americans. You know, and it's been done. It's been done by a number of local governments out there. So Bristol, Virginia, for example, a very small town, you know, I think less than 20,000 people, they have fiber to the home.
So this is a really, it's a political issue as well. So what can people be asking their representatives? I mean, what can they do in order to help change this in some way?
So I think the ask has been consistent. I think every legislator hears from their people back home, what about broadband? Where's my broadband? And I think people just have to start narrowing the ask to, when am I going to get fiber to the home? Or when am I going to get, and what are you doing to push fiber to my market? Because when you say, you know, I want broadband, sometimes what the industry tries to do is says, you know, hey, we got some satellites here. Right. Or, you know, we got some nice DSL technology coming along the way and really undersell, you know, and really undersell rural Americans. They should be asking for a strong commitment for the, you know, what is essentially a technology that's proven to scale upwards for very cost efficient means. To explain that real quick, I mean, once you lay the fiber, what we have seen so far, and we've seen this in Chattanooga, Tennessee, which is the world's fastest ISP. Once the fiber was laid, once the electronics get faster, the network gets faster. So you don't have to replace the wires, and you don't have to do this expensive construction project multiple times to keep the network up to speed. You just need to change out the ends of the wire, if you will, where the processing power. And you know, that's how Chattanooga went from a gigabit network about 9 years ago, if I believe about 9 years ago, to a 10 gigabit network for very little money.
I feel like broadband as a terminology has been kind of co-opted to a certain degree, not to necessarily describe a certain speed of internet, but just like any internet that's, air quotes, fast. You know what I mean? And like, yep, you were saying, that could be translated into DSL depending on how it's being spoken about, but they are kind of different things. So today there's actually a news hook. There's news with about President Trump signing a directive to the Commerce Department for developing a national spectrum strategy. And that's in preparation of 5G networks. So why now? Is this kind of part of what you're talking about here? And do you think this is going to help to address the problems from this report? Is it even enough?
So it definitely stems from the political effort from the wireless industry to get the government to prioritize more wireless attention. And as I mentioned in my piece, that serves two purposes. One, you know, they're not wrong in trying to push 5G and trying to push regulators and folks to rethink policies to promote it, but it helps them avoid the cold hard reality of monopoly. And the reason why it's a monopoly issue we have in this country is if they're not building fiber to the home, no one's going to build something that's faster than your cable companies today. The cable industry, for the most part, has rolled out gigabit networks this year, which is a great thing, except for the fact that if we don't have someone who also rolled out a speed that is equal or faster, then they will charge you through the nose. I mean, they will charge you, on average, 200 to 400% a competitive rate, because you don't have a choice. And if you have a service or you use if you use the internet and you need a high speed connection, you don't have a choice. You have to pay that price. And 68 million people are forced with that. So, you know, I think it would have been great if it was a 5G executive order and a fiber to the home executive order, right? Like it needs to be both at the end of the day.
Yeah. As we've seen with, you know, with these markets, competition is the answer, right? Like Google Fiber comes into a market and then suddenly everybody else that's operating in that market really needed to step up their game, offer very fast internet for not as much, you know, not ridiculously expensive cost. And that happened. The problem is fiber, you know, Google Fiber as an effort is kind of going away. A lot of that competition is dwindling away, and that's kind of what this is all about. So that's kind of sad. Should the focus be more on building out 4G networks in some of these rural areas instead of like dropping the ball and being like, oh, well, let's focus on this now? Because, I mean, some of these markets don't even have good 4G.
Yeah, I think it has to be kind of all of the above. I mean, rural markets need decent mobility for the purposes that you mentioned, that was mentioned earlier, particularly in kind of farm country. So one of the advantages of 4G versus 5G is 4G towers are able to have a very long range. One of the biggest limitations of 5G and why I don't think it will change much of anything for rural country is, you know, on average, they reach about 1,000 feet per tower. 1,000 feet from the tower that the fiber itself has to connect to is just unworkable without any sort of subsidy effort to build the fiber network in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, it's like saying each farmer gets one tower from themselves, and it's like that's just uneconomical without any way to kind of recuperate those costs. So 4G is important. Unlicensed is extraordinarily important. A lot of what are called wireless ISPs, called WISPAs, they depend on the fact that they don't have to pay expensive licenses to get the ability to transmit information. Even in urban markets, it's really important because, you know, in Alameda, for example, nearby here, there's a small ISP called Common Networks. And what they do is they connect to the fiber backhaul in a place near Oakland. And then they kind of rely on this mesh network to connect about a couple thousand people to fairly high speeds at a low price. But they rely on the fact that they don't have to pay a license to be able to transmit. And that is dependent on the stuff that powers our Wi-Fi and anything else that allows, you don't have to negotiate any sort of contract with a license holder.
Yeah, right on. Ernesto Falcone, you're obviously with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF.org. If people want to follow you online, where would you point them?
Follow me on Twitter. I put myself out there just EFFF. So my last name is Falcone, and so I go EFF and then my last name. So EFF Falcon.
I like it. All right. Ernesto, thank you for joining us once again. We always love having you on. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care. Up next, how to enforce safety in the age of shared scooters. This is a hot topic week, and we're going to discuss it all about it. But first, let's take a moment to thank the sponsor of Tech News Weekly. This episode is brought to you by Command Line Heroes, which is an original podcast for geeks by geeks from Red Hat. Command Line Heroes is dedicated to telling the epic true tales of the developers, the programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels who are revolutionizing the technology landscape. So you might be asking, what's a command line hero? You might be one if you've ever taken something apart to see how it works, or you'd rather make your own even. Command Line Heroes are the makers, they're the builders, the dreamers, the doers who are transforming tech and shaping our tomorrows. Season 2 is all about living on the command line and tracking the changes that shape the world of open source development. They're discovering the origins of programming languages. They're mastering the art of making a pull request, learning about supercomputers, hybrid clouds, and more. Command Line Heroes is produced by Red Hat, an open source company that started in an apartment 25 years ago and, as you know, knows a thing or two about where tech came from and where it's going. Season 2 is also hosted by Saranyet Barak, a developer who founded Code Newbie, hosts two other tech podcasts, and lives and breathes open source software. They're taking Season 2 to great heights and beyond, and hope that you'll go with them. Episode 1 launched on September 11th, so visit redhat.com/heroes to check it out today. Subscribe to Command Line Heroes wherever you get your podcasts, and visit redhat.com/heroes for extras and to learn more. That's redhat.com TwitterTV.com/heroes. And we thank them for their support of Tech News Weekly.
Writing on The Verge this week, Deputy Editor Elizabeth Lopato says scooter companies are moving fast and breaking people, but the scooter companies say they are not to blame. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth.
Hi, Megan. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So what got you interested in writing about these new scooter companies, which I guess are not so new anymore?
I mean, I live in Oakland, and so it's one of the places where there was a trial of these things that wasn't necessarily approved by the city council, and I see them all the time.
So you're a bike, like you bike around, you commute, I guess. That was part of your story. Do they get in your way?
It depends. Not always. But, you know, I've definitely run into people on scooters who are going the wrong way in a bike lane, going against traffic and doing a bunch of other wild things that it just feels like is somewhat encouraged by the sort of random way in which the scooter showed up in the community to begin with. There wasn't discussion with the community at all before the scooters arrived. They just showed up one day and, you know, they showed up on the sidewalk. And so I think a lot of people thought it would be okay to ride on the sidewalk. And it turns out that's a little bit hazardous for pedestrians.
So are these business people commuting around Oakland? Are they kids or is it a mix?
It depends on what time of day it is, right? So like in the mornings, you might see somebody who is a business commuter on a scooter. Usually after school, you do tend to see a younger crowd. But, you know, mostly I'm not seeing people who are, and again, obviously this is anecdotal, but I'm not seeing a lot of people who are over the age of about 40 who are on the scooters.
If kids are riding these scooters, how are they? Like, isn't that against the rules? Like, I'm sure there's an age limit. I think you pointed out it's 18 and up is required. So there are checks in here that should be limiting the usage, but I can think back to when I was a kid. If I saw a scooter on the side of the road, like, heck yeah, I'd want to ride it, and I'd figure out how I could do that. Like,
do you have a credit card?
Well, that's what my question is. How are they getting around that? Yeah. If they're under 18, they're figuring it out somehow.
I mean, my guess is that there's a parent who is providing the credit card. Although, you know, depending on what kind of teenager you are, sometimes it's possible to get a hold of a fake ID or whatever. Again, this goes back to the issue of not really talking to the community before you dropped these things here, because scooters are basically motorized versions of children's toys, right? Like, naturally, as a kid and maybe even as a parent, you're thinking, oh, this is probably pretty harmless, like, no big deal. I don't really have to, you know, control for this. But they go pretty fast. The speed's capped at 15 miles per hour, but that's still faster than I bike most of the time. And at those speeds, with the sort of the physics of the scooters, the possibility of getting in a wreck either just by yourself or with someone else can be pretty serious, right? Like, you know, the center of gravity is pretty high. Those wheels are really small, and the scooters are not the most stable things in the world.
No.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess I know parents who give their kids an Uber account or a Lyft account to get around sometimes. So I guess maybe they would feel more comfortable on a scooter rather than with the ride sharing driver, but I don't know. So you went to a town hall that was called for this over this scooter issue with some representatives from the scooter companies. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so what's going on is that Oakland is going to require permits for scooters, and they're going to be accepting applications later this year. And this was just sort of a town hall where the scooter companies presented what they were doing. And, you know, the thing that really stuck out to me, having sort of been involved with other parts of tech, is how oddly it mirrored some of the stuff that we've heard out of Facebook and out of Twitter about how they're not really responsible for the entirely predictable bad uses of their product. And that really struck me, because I'm not saying that there's nothing that can come of those kinds of bad uses online. Like, obviously, we've seen a bunch of bad things happen, including but not limited to genocide. But when it comes to something like scooters, there's an immediate physical risk of harm. And so, you know, dumping the scooters and then coming through after the fact and being like, oh, we can't be responsible for the way people are using them strikes me as really absurd.
Yeah, especially when you consider, like you point out a number of times in your article about helmets and the lack thereof, right? And like, just this whole idea that a scooter is very much a, oh, hey, there's one on the ground, I think I'll ride it. Not a, I'm planning to go out onto the sidewalk and find me a scooter, so I'm going to bring this helmet from home. You probably don't have a helmet with you. And like, so inherently, just by that, to that end, this entire market is just a really unsafe market, because no one's going to just ran, you know, you can't pack a helmet into your pocket. You just can't do that.
Right. And like, this is one of the things that actually in transit spaces can be pretty contentious. I happen to be on the side of helmets. There are people who say, oh, well, you know, being helmetless means that there are more people who are not, who are riding bikes or who are on scooters, and so that's safer. And like, I was in a bad bike wreck last year, wearing a helmet, thankfully, and sustained a concussion that like laid me out for about a month. And I'm just thinking, again, I wasn't going as fast as these scooters were going. So when you put all of these things together, I think that helmets are probably a pretty important issue, especially, again, because of the way that the center of gravity on the scooter is positioned. Like, you don't have to be in a wreck with a car for it to be a fairly bad injury.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
Well, I mean, you said this is reflective of the beginning of the internet, which I totally agree, except for the difference is that no one really paid attention at the beginning of Facebook or even the beginning of the internet. There were all these, you know, people saying like, oh, everything's going to be wonderful. And if someone gets hurt, that's their problem. And, you know, just in general, there wasn't a lot of complaints. But it does seem to be like the scooter companies aren't getting off that easy. Like some of them were kicked out of San Francisco, which I guess is what brought them to Oakland. But people are really complaining. And maybe because we've learned from the internet, or maybe because it's right in our face.
You know, I couldn't tell you which it is, to be honest. I do know that property issues are often the most contentious in any community. And this is something of a property issue because these things are on the sidewalk. And especially if they're on, you know, parts of the sidewalk where people ordinarily walk, or where, you know, people with wheelchairs are trying to, you know, get around, that's a very big deal. So that might be part of it. I also think that part of it was watching Uber basically do the same thing, and, you know, promising, oh, yeah, we're going to have fewer cars on the road. And then the data has come out this year showing, actually, no, there are more cars on the road because of Uber. So I think it may be the case that people are a little bit more skeptical than they used to be, in part because they've already seen where some of this behavior leads.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting, because the other thing you point out in this article is, I mean, the scooter companies might be saying, well, we're solving that last mile problem. We're getting, like you said, we're getting fewer cars, fewer Ubers on the road. But what you point out is what you've seen mostly, and again, anecdotally, but I think I've seen this as well, it's replacing walking in a lot of places.
Well, I mean, if you look at the length of the trip, it's about a mile, right? And like, when the heat maps were presented at the City Hall meeting, most of the activity was in downtown Oakland. And like, I can tell you that there's not a lot of parking there. If you're going a mile, it's unlikely you're going to drive, because you're going to be spending as much time looking for a parking spot as you are driving. So probably what's happening is that a lot of people who would be walking aren't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So someone in our chat room says, like, have we lost the ability to walk a mile? And I think
yes.
Some people have. Yes.
We're getting there.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us. Elizabeth Lopato is a deputy editor at The Verge, and she is Ms. Lopato on Twitter. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We appreciate it.
All right. Pop quiz.
I'm ready.
Are you ready?
I think so.
What is scarier, robots or wasps?
Wasps. Well, I mean, what has hurt me in the past? Uh-huh. Wasps have definitely hurt me. But robots, I fear them.
Ah, interesting.
For the future. For the future.
Wasps. Have you been stung by a wasp?
Oh, I've got wasp stories.
Interesting.
Yes. Yes,
okay, so how about this? A robot designed with the powers of the wasp, according to IEEE Spectrum. Robotics researchers have built robots that can fit in the palm of your hand, much like a wasp, but can also anchor themselves to the ground or to walls and then manipulate objects 40 times their own mass. I didn't even know that this is what wasps could do, but apparently they can, and they do, to like carry their prey around. These are called MAVs, and they could be especially helpful in disaster zones and also in my nightmares.
Yeah, very helpful in your nightmares. Yes. And you don't even need to wait for them to hit the market. You could just dream this up tomorrow. Don't worry. They're not coming anytime soon. The battery life is like 5 minutes on these things. Uh-huh. So there isn't a whole lot of longevity there, but it's a start. They're also not fully like fully autonomous or even semi-autonomous. I think they are entirely controlled by humans at this point because they're so small, but that doesn't mean it's not going to happen. The video is very interesting though. It's really cool to kind of like watch them slide the thing under the door and then the next one comes over and throws the hook around the doorknob or the handle and then they work together and just kind of like slide back on the carpet and it takes longer than you think it's going to.
Yeah.
But the point is they did it.
And they don't sting either.
Yeah, they don't sting yet.
Yeah.
Remind me to tell you after the show is done. I'll tell you a wasp story that you'll have nightmares about. Talk about nightmares, Maroney.
Have you seen wasps move things 40 times their own weight?
No. If I see wasps, I run away.
Okay.
Because I hate them.
Okay. Good to know.
If you ever want to exact revenge on me, throw like a bunch of wasps towards me and I will leave.
Okay.
I will be gone.
Good to know.
Everybody, you all know this about me now. Isn't that cool, though? It's just like, it's slow, but it works. And then I think at the very end, another like tiny little drone goes zoop, right through the opening of the door.
Yeah.
Here, it's probably going to come here. Yeah, come on. Come on, little drone. Yeah, there you are. You're welcome. See you later.
Yeah.
The bathroom's around the corner.
Did the wasp fly up your nose?
No, it trapped me at the top of a fort when I was a kid. There were like five of them and they stung me and I had to jump out of the fort. It was really frightening. It's a story I tell my kids to this day. Isn't that delightful? to give them nightmares. Tech News, I'm not a bad dad, I promise. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live. You could be a part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv. Tell us your wasp stories.
Mm-hmm. That's why I'm not building you a fort, kids.
Yes, exactly.
Subscribe to our show at twit.tv/tnw. Subscribe and tell your friends to subscribe. A good way for us to spread the word is through you. You know, just say like, have you listened to this podcast? They tell crazy wasp robot stories. That's a good thing you can tell your friends.
Yeah, totally.
Mm-hmm. And if you have told your friends about it, tweet that at me. I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to everybody who helps us do the show every day. Thanks to Josh. Thanks to Burke. Thanks to John was in here earlier, Colleen. Everybody helps us. We really appreciate it. And thanks to you for watching. We'll see you next week on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.